Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 16, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the Schuette versus Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action case argued just yesterday in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call two experts. We're going to hear first from Ms. Jennifer Gratz, who was lead plaintiff in the landmark case Gratz v. Bollinger, which challenged affirmative action at the University of Michigan some years ago. She is also the founder and CEO of the 14 Foundation. Then we'll hear opening remarks from Mr. Robert Driscoll. He is a partner at the law firm of Friedlander and Meisler. And we're happy to have both of them here today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, then maybe a little bit of discussion, and then, as always, we'll be taking questions from the audience, so please make sure to have your questions ready. Ms. Gratz, with that, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm going to start by talking about the background and how we ended up at the Supreme Court, and then Bob is going to take over and talk a little bit about the arguments yesterday. As Dean said, I am indeed the woman who sued the University of Michigan for racial discrimination in admissions at the undergraduate school, and my lawsuit went to the Supreme Court in 2003. Along with the Grutter case, where Barbara Grutter sued the University of Michigan's law school, also the racial discrimination in admissions. When the Gratz and Grutter decisions came down, I won my case, but it was nothing more than a personal victory, and I didn't feel very victorious. And the next day, I was with one of my attorneys, Terry Pell, and we were talking about the decision, and I said, something has to be done about this. And he responded with, if you're serious, a ballot initiative would be what you could do about this. And I don't think that he thought I was all that serious, but within hours, I was on the phone making plans to uproot my life. I was living in San Diego at the time, move back to my home state, and start a ballot initiative to amend the Michigan Constitution. I thought that this was the right thing to do, not only because I believe in fairness and equality, and I believe that our Constitution should be colorblind, but because of a portion of the decision in Grutter, where the majority said, universities, and this is a quote, universities in California, Florida, and Washington, where racial preferences and admissions are prohibited by state law, are currently engaged in experimenting with a wide variety of alternative approaches. Universities in other states can and should draw on the most promising aspects of these race-neutral alternatives as they develop. California, of course, had passed a constitutional amendment via ballot initiative in 1996. And so I took that as an instruction to simply work harder, to take the message to the voters. And so that's exactly what we did. I was cautioned that the campaign would be brutal, that all of the usual suspects would line up against us. But no one expected just how brutal that campaign was. We had the usual suspects, the ACLU, the NAACP, the Democrats, the unions, big business, all pour in funds and resources to oppose our campaign. But we also had others, unexpected, the Republican Party, the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, groups and organizations that should have been on our side also either opposed or sat out. And so I take great issue with the argument that's presented that it would be too difficult for the other side to mount a campaign to undo what the people of Michigan has done. They had huge resources, both in terms of dollars and in terms of manpower. In fact, during our campaign, my opponents often said that it was too easy to amend Michigan's state constitution and that someone should do something to make it harder to amend the constitution. The campaign was beyond brutal. We had every argument you could imagine thrown at us. From if the simple language of the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative passed, which I'll remind you what that language is, the state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any group or individual on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, and public contracting. If that language should pass, women would not be able to enter math and science programs anymore. Women would not be able to play sports anymore. Breast cancer screening centers could be shut down. There was a radio ad that ran that compared the potential passage of the initiative to the tragedies of Hurricane Katrina and 9/11. A former U.S. senator, not from Michigan, he came into Michigan and ran radio ads asking people to vote no on Prop 2. That former U.S. senator is now President Obama. And despite all of this, the people of Michigan saw through the rhetoric and said, no, we believe in equality. We believe that the University of Michigan and other universities, our state entities, should be judging people based on their character and their merit and not their skin color or their sex. And on Election Day, they voted by a 16-point margin, 58% to 42%, to approve and place into the Constitution that simple language that is directly in line with the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The morning after Election Day, I woke up feeling like I was on cloud nine. Surely the universities, the state, everyone would just abide by this law at this point. I quickly learned that that was not the case. Mary Sue Coleman, the president of the University of Michigan, the morning after Election Day in 2006, she stood and spoke to about 1,000 people and essentially declared war on Section 26, the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, which was now a part of the Michigan Constitution. And she commanded her legal team to find ways around the law and find ways to challenge the law. And sure enough, within days after that, the radical group, By Any Means Necessary, they go by the acronym of BAM, joined by other special interest groups, filed a lawsuit that virtually no one took seriously at the time, challenging the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, challenging that equality violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. People didn't take this seriously, at least partly because the same challenge had been made in the late 90s against the California Civil Rights Initiative, which passed in 1996, and the Ninth Circuit had upheld the California amendment and basically thrown those arguments out of court. I think that legalese and jurisprudence aside, there isn't a layperson I know that can wrap their head around the idea that a state constitutional command for equal treatment somehow violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. We finally took this lawsuit seriously when it ended up at the Sixth Circuit. And myself and the chairman of the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, Leon Drolet, we traveled to Cincinnati to hear arguments in front of the court. And it was as we walked in that we realized we were in trouble. We were again outmanned. We were outmaneuvered. The typical groups and organizations that work on the side of the civil rights initiatives weren't really anywhere to be found. And the other side was organized from a both legal standpoint and from a PR and social standpoint. And as we sat listening to arguments, we both came to the conclusion that we were going to lose. Immediately following those arguments on our drive back to Detroit from Cincinnati, I sent a note out to a handful of people, insiders, letting them know that I thought we were going to lose. And I was told that I was overreacting, that it would be just fine. And sure enough, a few months later, the decision came out and we lost 8-7. I'm very thankful that the Supreme Court did take up this case. Otherwise, the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative would be unconstitutional today. I find it curious that the By Any Means Necessary and the ACLU that they've only challenged a portion of the law. They've only challenged the university admissions with respect to race. There is a gender component to the amendment, and the amendment does apply to public contracting, public employment, and public education. I do also have to note the way that the arguments from our opponents have changed. In 2003, when the University of Michigan argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, they argued that race preferences were needed in order to achieve diversity, and that they were for the primary benefit of all people, of the entire campus. And the court actually said that if these policies were for the benefit, the primary benefit of minorities, or if they were for racial balancing, that they would be patently unconstitutional. Yesterday, the BAM and the ACLU argued in front of the court exactly the opposite. These policies are in place for the primary benefit of minorities, and that is why it is unconstitutional for the majority to decide to eliminate these policies. And it seems to me that their lawsuit cannot stand with Grutter also standing. And so that was something that I've noted many times over the last couple of months. I think that Solicitor General John Birch, who argued the case on behalf of the Michigan Attorney General's office, did a absolutely phenomenal job in front of the court. And I think that Shanta Driver from By Any Means Necessary actually embarrassed herself when she presented to the court that the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution only applies to some groups, specifically only applies to Black people. And I also think that Justice Sotomayor was quite unjudicial when she, from the bench, indicated that potentially eliminating alumni preferences was another way to change the rules on minorities, just as they're gaining ground and being able to benefit from alumni preferences. Those were the two things that I really noted. I believe that we're going to win this case, but I also believe that we will continue discussing and talking about and debating race preferences and whether our Constitution and our laws should be colorblind, as I believe the 64 Civil Rights Act told us to be and commanded us to be for many years to come. I don't think that this will be a decision that will end these policies forever. And Bob Driscoll has become a friend, and he filed the amicus brief for the organization that I founded on the day that the Sixth Circuit decision came out. It's the XIV Foundation, named after the 14th Amendment, and I'm really grateful to Bob and his work that he's done on these issues, and he's going to talk a little bit about arguments yesterday.
Thanks, Jennifer. Again, my interest in these matters began back in the original Gratz case, when I was actually working for the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division. And was involved in the affirmative action cases at that time. And my interest has continued, and so occasionally take a break from my regular practice to be involved in these cases. It's up to me to explain. I'll try to do a fair job how this case ended up in the court and what happened yesterday. I know at first blush it really, and it seemed to me, and I'm sure it seems to most people, incomprehensible that a constitutional amendment at a state level mandating equal treatment can be held to violate the Equal Protection Clause. But that's what the Sixth Circuit held in an en banc 8-7 decision. And that decision was based on a principle called the Political Restructuring Doctrine. The Political Restructuring Doctrine is a line essentially of two cases interpreting the Equal Protection Clause. The cases are, the latest one is the Seattle case from 1982. The case before that was the Hunter case from Akron, Ohio, from the 70s or late 60s. And essentially what these cases held was that it was a violation of equal protection to essentially repeal or remove a specific local policy that benefited minority groups or a minority group and remove that to the state level. And so, for example, or to a higher political level that made it more difficult for minority group to achieve its political aims. So, for example, in the Hunter case in Akron, Ohio, the Akron board had passed a fair housing ordinance, a local fair housing ordinance, that required local landlords to rent to anybody of any race. And in reaction, a law was passed at a state level that required such ordinances to be submitted to the voters of a jurisdiction in order to take effect. It was a unique requirement for just housing statutes having to do with race. And it was pretty clear, I think, from the context of the case that the court was concerned that this was essentially there was some discriminatory animus behind the move to repeal this fair housing ordinance. And so the court declared the later move by the state unconstitutional. In Seattle, it was similar facts having to do with busing program implemented by Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington. Local school boards had adopted voluntary desegregated busing programs that were not constitutionally required. The voters of the state disagreed with that and amended the Washington state constitution in such a way as to prevent local school boards from busing for desegregated purposes. And again, the court held in that much closer case in 1982 that constitutional amendment violated the Equal Protection Clause because essentially it restructured the political process for this narrow issue. It was an issue predominantly of local control, but it was removed to a state constitutional level by the voters and essentially made it more difficult for minority groups in Seattle and Tacoma to achieve their preferred ends, which was integrative busing. Those two cases have kind of laid dormant for a long time. The political restructuring doctrine has not been used by the court, I think, since 1982 in any significant way. What's particularly interesting about the doctrine is that you may remember the Romer case, the gay rights case essentially out of Colorado, originally started as a political restructuring case, but even in that decision, the court did not rely on the political restructuring doctrine or Hunter in Seattle in order to make that decision. So this case, it's important to realize, is not directly an affirmative action case. A lot of the discussion from the bench was about affirmative action and the benefits of affirmative action or different statistics related to affirmative action in Michigan, but it really was not did not turn on Gratz or Grutter or Fisher. None of those cases were really precedent that would affect this case too much. It was really about the vitality of the political restructuring doctrine. Again, as Jennifer said, John Birch from the Solicitor General's Office in Michigan did a fantastic job. Essentially, I think he took the prudential approach of trying to distinguish the Hunter-Seattle line of cases rather than expressly asking the court to overrule Hunter in Seattle. I think he would acknowledge that there's a lot wrong with the Hunter-Seattle cases, that they don't make sense in modern equal protection jurisprudence, but I think he recognized that asking the court to overturn that line of cases was something that was unnecessary for him to do to win, and so he focused a lot on distinguishing the cases, and the primary distinction, he argued, was that the Michigan Amendment requires equal treatment. It is a ban on special preferences. Whereas in Hunter and in Seattle, the statutes that were repealed or the local policies that were repealed themselves required equal treatment. And he thought that was a great basis to distinguish Seattle and Hunter if the court felt compelled to leave those intact. The interesting thing about the Seattle-Hunter doctrine, and Jennifer touched on this with respect to the argument by Shanta Driver, is that the test under the Seattle-Hunter doctrine as to whether or not a political restructuring has occurred is the first thing the court has to do is look as to whether a policy in question benefits the minority. And I think that people that follow the civil rights area closely and look at the court's equal protection cases have realized that for a while the court has expressly taken a essentially a colorblind approach with respect to the Equal Protection Clause and has held since the days of Crozen and Adirond and other cases that it really shouldn't matter whose ox is getting gored, in a sense, that the level of scrutiny a particular state action should receive should not be dependent on whether or not it is a minority group benefiting from a racial classification or whether or not the majority is benefiting. And there was an interesting exchange that happened in the court yesterday when Shantidriver argued, and I actually wrote it down in my notes because I found it, and checked it against the transcript today. I found it remarkable, where she argued, really at the beginning of her argument, that part of her argument was to take the 14th Amendment, quote, back to its original purpose and meaning, which is protect minority rights against a white majority. And she was explicit that that's what she was asking the court to do. That obviously, that principle would conflict with a lot of the court's equal protection jurisprudence, particularly in the last, 20 years or so. Justice Scalia predictably looked like he would jump over the bench when she suggested that to the court and asked her to identify a single case where the court had held that to be the case interpreting the Equal Protection Clause. She could not, and she was then bailed out by friendlier questioning from Justices Sotomayor and Breyer. The argument yesterday to give people the kind of scorecard, which I think people want to have, Justice Kagan recused herself from the case, likely because of work she did in the Solicitor General's office. So there were only 8 justices hearing the case yesterday. What that means, because the Sixth Circuit declared the amendment unconstitutional, is that in the event of a 4-4 split, the Sixth Circuit decision would remain, and the amendment would be unconstitutional. So that is a risk of an 8-justice panel hearing the arguments. Although I think most observers do not think there is much risk of there being any verdict or any ruling other than a reversal. I think it's fairly clear the Chief and Justice Scalia and Justice Alito were all very skeptical to the arguments raised by the respondents. Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg were very much in favor of the arguments being raised by the respondents and were defending the Sixth Circuit reasoning. Justice Kennedy asked tough questions of both sides. It is clear that he was looking for ways to distinguish the Seattle Hunter line of cases. I don't think he was necessarily looking to overrule them, but he was, I think, looking to distinguish them. And also Justice Breyer, frankly, asked several questions where he clearly is troubled by the lack of any limiting principle of the Seattle Hunter line of cases. John Birch did an excellent job arguing that if you take Seattle Hunter line of cases to their logical extension, and you say that any state law or state policy that mentions race at all is in effect has a racial focus or a racial classification, and therefore is subject to strict scrutiny if it's removed to a more remote political level, that logic applied for example, the Fair Housing Act, the Federal Fair Housing Act, would make the Federal Fair Housing Act unconstitutional because it takes anyone who wants to argue for preferences at the local level and preferences in housing based on race is not allowed to do so because it's been removed by the Federal Fair Housing Act, and you have to amend the U.S. Code in order to do that. So I think that John Birch did an excellent job drawing those analogies, and those analogies troubled, I think, Justice Breyer and Justice Kennedy, who I think are the two justices that kind of at least argued both sides of this case. My prediction would be I think it's going to be a win for the state of Michigan. I think the Sixth Circuit is going to be reversed. I think it could be a significant majority, particularly if the court decides to merely distinguish the Seattle and Hunter cases rather than attempt to overrule them. I'm not sure there's 5 justices to overrule the entire line of cases, and so I think it's more likely there'll be some kind of decision that cabins in those decisions or limits their applicability to future cases, but preserves the Michigan constitutional amendment. I hope that was an adequate description of the argument. We're available, I think, to take questions at this point. I'll throw it back to Dean. It was certainly an interesting day to be in the court, and again, for those who are advocates like Jennifer of this amendment, I think they were ably represented by Solicitor Birch, and I think that I haven't talked to any observer who thinks that any outcome other than a reversal is very likely.
Well, thank you very much. Let's do, we got over 100 people on the call, so let's turn to the audience and see what's on their minds. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions, so the audience not yet quite thoroughly engaged, but let's go to our first caller.
This is David Applegate, an attorney in private practice in Chicago. Was there any mention during the argument or the questioning from the bench of what race means in America and how to determine it?
There was not any direct discussion of that point. I think the only kind of related question that was raised was the question of whether or not actually wasn't really a related question, whether or not the affirmative action racial preference programs were beneficial, in fact beneficial to minorities, and could therefore meet the Seattle Hunter test under that prong. Given the evidence that's been adduced that preference programs may, in fact, not benefit those who they are originally intended to. But there was no broader discussion of what race means in America, other than from, I guess, Shanta Davis, who argued that the role of the Equal Protection Clause is to protect minority groups against the white majority, and that the Equal Protection Clause should be interpreted with respect to power relationships among various groups in the country, and the court was to analyze kind of who had power and who didn't in determining which groups deserve protection under the Equal Protection Clause.
But suppose my great-grandmother was black and I didn't even discover it until I was researching my ancestry. Where would I fall? Doesn't the court need to address some issues before there is any coherence in this area of the law?
It didn't come up yesterday. I think I tend to agree, and I think that's what it's one of the, I guess, sub-arguments that would support the more race-neutral or race-blind interpretation of the Equal Protection Clause the court has had recently, which essentially the purpose of the Equal Protection Clause is to take race off the table. The chief noted that although this amendment had a racial focus in terms of the topic of the amendment was race, the purpose of the amendment was to eliminate race from consideration, not to have the state focus on race, and that it wasn't that. At the end of the day, he posited the full purpose of the Equal Protection Clause in order to remove race from consideration. But there was no broader discussion of what it means to be a certain race in America today.
Thank you.
I'll just add that from an activist standpoint rather than a legal standpoint, one of the things that I've been advised to advise people to do is, well, first of all, that race is a social construct. So it's whatever you identify with. In California, you can actually, within the University of California system, you can change your race. There's a form where you can go in and, you know, one day you may have been black and the next day you can decide that you're no longer black. So with that, I often talk about messing with the data. I think that there's no quicker way to move past these policies if the court isn't going to do it for us than to mess with the data. And at this point, I would mention that the University of Michigan has changed the way that they keep their data. And that's actually how they've manipulated the statistics in their brief, in the University of Michigan's brief. Prior to the Civil Rights Initiative passing, applicants could only check one box based on what race they were. After the initiative passed, they could check multiple check boxes. So if you had a father of one race and a mother of another, you could check two boxes. When someone checks multiple boxes right now, that person is not considered part of their diversity makeup. They're essentially considered a Caucasian student, or part of the majority. And that's how they've manipulated the statistics and the numbers to say that there's been this drastic dip in minority acceptance rates. When you actually look at the data prior to them doing that, they did it not the first year after the initiative passed, but within the second year. The first year after the initiative passed, they themselves, University of Michigan, put out a press release saying that there weren't these drastic results. In fact, the diversity rates at the university had been maintained almost identically and went down, I think it was a quarter of a percentage point between prior to the passage and after the passage. But I think it's significant to watch that data and watch how they manipulate it.
Again, thank you.
We've got two questions in the queue now. If you want to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the next caller, I'm going to announce that tomorrow at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, our Teleforum conference call will feature Chuck Cooper, the litigator, as he discusses a case he's involved with that concerns diversity jurisdiction for federal court purposes. Slightly different definition of diversity, I suppose, but let's now go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Arthur Hellman. Of course, I was not in the courtroom, but I did read the transcript, and I guess I wasn't as convinced that Justice Kennedy is not on the fence. He seemed to pose pretty tough questions to the Michigan Attorney General, and particularly the suggestion that it's rather hard to distinguish the Seattle case. I wonder, Bob, if you have further comments on that.
No, I think that it's – I don't think it's a given that Justice Kennedy will come out in favor of Michigan. I think what – well, he did start off with some tough questions to John Birch. I think he also, later in the argument, appeared to agree and echo some of the hypotheticals asked by the Chief and Justice Alito with respect to the lack of a limiting principle for the political restructuring doctrine. And in particular, the hypothetical that was thrown out was that if the test is that essentially any removing a decision to a higher political level that makes achieving a goal more difficult for a given minority group implicates the political restructuring doctrine. In an instance like this, where a faculty has adopted an affirmative action policy, suppose a dean is opposed to affirmative action and overrules the faculty committee, or suppose the president overrules the dean, or suppose the board of trustees overrules the president, or then suppose and this couldn't happen in Michigan because of peculiarities of the Michigan Constitution, but suppose the legislature overruled the board of trustees. And then finally, you have the constitutional amendment. Where in line does the political restructuring doctrine be implicated? Because the results certainly seem strange that everyone would have essentially the power to make a determination as to whether or not Michigan would have affirmative action at their universities, with the exception of the people, which is kind of the way the Sixth Circuit came out. And I think on that line of questioning, Justice Kennedy was, following the lead of the Chief and Justice Alito. So I didn't mean to imply that that Kennedy's in the bag in any sense. I think he asked questions that were difficult to both sides, and I think he was looking for limiting principles. But I certainly think he was not. He did indeed open up by saying that he was having a hard time distinguishing the Seattle decision from this decision, from this case. And frankly, I agree with him in that sense. And I actually think the cleanest way to draw a line between the two points is to overrule Seattle. But, I mean, that's just me, and I think the court's unlikely to go there. But I think that Justice Kennedy raised a very real problem for defenders of the Michigan Amendment, that is, if Seattle remains as it is, and you take all of the language in Seattle literally into its logical extension, it does create problems.
Well, I can't remember if it was Justice Kennedy, but one of the justices, I thought, said, well, maybe you can avoid that where do you stop problem by simply saying, well, it's constitutional amendments that are special.
Right, and I think that was a proposed, I think it was actually Justice Alito who drew that proposition, but
yes,
he was drawing it in order to elicit the response he got from John Birch, which was that's not an adequate dividing line, because essentially then the Michigan Equal Protection Clause itself falls under the logic of Seattle. Michigan has its own Equal Protection Clause parallel to the 14th Amendment, which requires equal treatment on the basis of race more generally than this specific amendment here. And that, again, would be an amendment with a racial focus that prevents people at lower levels of government from arguing for preferences in favor of minorities.
Did Sadler really say any change that has a racial focus? I mean, is that language appealing?
Yeah, racial focus was indeed language out of Seattle, and that is one of the key problems. And I think John Birch did a great job trying to argue that really what Seattle meant, although they didn't say it, was that there needed to be some sort of racial animus, that a racial classification would trigger strict scrutiny, but a race-neutral law simply that had a racial focus would not trigger strict scrutiny. And I think that the support for that is that the same day Seattle was decided in 1982, a case called Crawford was decided about an amendment to the California Constitution that had to do with busing, which essentially repealed a state judicial ruling in California requiring busing that was not required under the federal constitution. And the court upheld that that constitutional amendment and discussed the fact that that amendment was not a sufficient racial classification to trigger a strict scrutiny, and made comments that it would be odd indeed if essentially mirroring the Equal Protection Clause violated the Equal Protection Clause. So there's a lot of question as to what the racial focus language means out of Seattle and how to interpret that, and that was one of the main points of disagreement.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
I take it, Mr. Driscoll, with regard to where Justice Kennedy sits in this case, it's essential for Michigan to win Justice Kennedy, because even with Justice Kagan recused, a 4-4 tie is a loss for Michigan.
Correct. And I think that I think that's right.
You think there's any possibility they could get Breyer and not Kennedy? That seems very, very unlikely.
I think it would be, looking historically at how people have voted on these issues, I think it would be unlikely. But frankly, Breyer and Kennedy both, I think, it appeared to me, and I'm just one observer, it appeared to me that both were looking for limiting principles on the Seattle Hunter Doctrine, on the political restructuring doctrine, and it's just a question of where they're going to draw the line. I can't imagine that if they both drew lines that Justice Kennedy's line would be, would be on the side that would invalidate the Michigan amendment, but Justice Breyer's would be on the side of the line that would preserve it. I think if anything, it would be the other way. But it's hard to know, and I think Justice Breyer, I could make a presumption that he'll support the Sixth Circuit decision, but his questions certainly, if you look at them neutrally, he certainly had some questions for the respondents that were pretty tough.
Thank you.
Jennifer Gratz, do you want to weigh in here, or should we go to the next caller?
I actually agreed with Bob on Breyer, and I think that he covered it well. So,
okay, we've got four questions pending. We've got about 20 minutes or so left. Let's go to the next caller.
Hello, this is Maddie Klausner calling from Los Angeles. I have a question that is triggered by a post by Ann Althaus today on her blog dealing with nomenclature. One of the things that we used when we drafted Prop 209 in California, which was the prototype for the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, we used the word racial preference or preferences based on sex or ethnicity rather than the term affirmative action. Now, some of the states that, in work with Ward Connolly, we were trying to put the ballot, a similar ballot measure on, needed to be amended. The state attorney general, secretary of state, required the use of the word preferences to be substituted, taken out, and instead the word affirmative action was put in it. Ann Althaus points out today that the caption of her piece is great, her post, when Nina Totenberg is calling affirmative action racial preferences, affirmative action is in trouble. And what Ann Althaus does is point out that during not only is Nina Totenberg doing it, but also Justice Breyer used in one of his questions, he used the term racial preferences rather than affirmative action. I was wondering if anyone, I didn't look at the transcript, I was wondering if any of the other justices that unexpectedly used the word racial preferences in lieu of affirmative action, and if you feel there's any significance in what Breyer, how he framed his question.
Yeah, well, I think you raise a great point, Manny, that I want to tell the audience. The chief gave John Birch the question to distinguish and noted, the chief noted that the term affirmative action had been being used and asked Solicitor Birch kind of the leading question, saying, but this case isn't really about affirmative action, is it? Which gave Birch the chance to bring up the distinction you're talking about and talk about that there were lots of things that didn't involve race, outrage, and other things that were not racial preferences that Michigan could and would still do under the amendment, and gave Birch a chance to draw that distinction. I didn't catch Breyer's use of the term preferences or in what context he used it, but I'll have to go read Althaus's post to see that. I don't know, Jennifer, if you caught that or not, but I do recall the chief having the colloquy with Solicitor Birch to bring out that point that affirmative action was not essentially what was prohibited by the amendment.
I don't recall any of the justices using the term preferences and me being that being unexpected. In fact, just the opposite. Yesterday I kept hearing the phrase affirmative action, and I was somewhat surprised by that, given that in both the Grutter and Gratz decisions, the phrase affirmative action was never used. It was consistently race preferences. I do want to point out to all of the callers, in case anyone doesn't know, Manny Klausner was the original author of the California Civil Rights Initiative, Prop 209, and therefore the author of the Michigan Initiative and the initiatives that followed. But when Manny talks about the language being changed, that was the ballot language, not the actual language that's been inserted into constitutions or into law in any of the states. In Michigan, for instance, the elections department put on the language that was on the ballot was, would you like to ban affirmative action programs that give preference based on race, color, ethnicity, or national origin in three areas, public contracting, public employment, and public education. So the phrase affirmative action was on the ballot, but is not part of Section 26. The pure language that was on the petition is what is the law. I have noticed, all of that said, I have noticed that the media has actually used the term preferences more frequently than they ever have in the past. The Detroit News headline had preferences in it rather than affirmative action, and I do think that's significant.
I appreciate the clarification and the comments. I'd just like to clarify myself that I was one of the authors, one of the drafters of 209, but I can't take sole credit. But I do applaud those who are using the word preferences, which is a much more precise term, and some of the states have yet to catch on. As I recall, Utah, I don't think it got on the ballot there, but as I recall, Utah to substitute the word affirmative action for preferences. I may be wrong. But anyway, yeah, you've done a great job, Jennifer, in all of these battles, and hopefully after this case we'll have a lot more fun with him.
Sounds good. It did not get on the ballot in Utah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Three questions. Thank you, Manny. Three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hi, this is Andy Karchner. I'm a law clerk up in D.C. I was wondering, did the court express any concern that striking down the Michigan law might read into the 14th Amendment a requirement for affirmative action, or at least, I'm sorry, racial preference, however you want to put it, or at least a requirement to maintain existing racial preferences policies? In other words, if rejecting racial preferences violates the 14th Amendment, then what instruction does that leave to the states on what policies they actually can and can't enact?
I would say the court didn't address that directly. It was raised in the briefing. It was interesting. Justice Alito, I think, tried to raise that point with a question to the respondents, and their answer, in my mind, was kind of curious based on the problem you raised. Justice Alito did ask, I think it was Mark Rosenbaum, the counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, who did the first half of the argument for the respondents, whether or not this case would come out any differently if there was no affirmative action program in place on the day the Michigan amendment passed. And the answer was no, that it wouldn't come out differently. I tend to think the answer would be yes, it would come out differently, and that if you apply the political restructuring doctrine as it's articulated in Seattle, it essentially would be a ratchet, like you refer to, that essentially would freeze in place places where affirmative action programs were already in use. They couldn't be altered by removing the political question of, as to whether or not to have affirmative action, to a higher level or more complex level of government, depending on how you read the cases. But if there were no existing affirmative action policy and you passed such a constitutional amendment, it wouldn't be repealing anything or affecting anything. And so I think it would be hard to apply the political restructuring doctrine there. So that question you raised was not raised directly at argument. It was raised in the briefs. And I think Alito was trying to get at it with a question to Rosenbaum, but the answer he gave didn't spark the discussion, largely because I think he didn't give the correct answer based on the interpretation he was arguing.
There was also an exchange between Robert and the Solicitor General about Grutter, and it gave the chance for John Birch, the Solicitor General, to put forth the idea that Grutter barely tolerated these policies, that did not mandate them. And I think that gets close to having the discussion about if we want to, should we be mandating these policies. That was actually, if I remember correctly, near the end of the argument.
All right, we've got two questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Paul Salamaka at the University of Kentucky. I wonder if this case might give the Supreme Court an opportunity to clarify Grutter a little bit. I know that most people read Grutter to be only about diversity in putting together the student body, but there are a couple of paragraphs in Justice O'Connor's opinion where she really seems to be talking about racial balancing. Even though she denies she's doing it, I think she says it. She says that all echelons of our society need to be visibly opened. And I wonder if that has sort of gone under the radar, and if that won't have to be addressed and either repudiated or put in context here, assuming that the court reverses the Sixth Circuit. And what I mean to say is, if the only effect of the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative is to eliminate preferences in the context of diversity and so on for putting together a student body, then you could make a fairly strong argument that it truly is neutral. But if the point of what Michigan was doing was actually to sort of impose some sort of regime of racial balancing, and that could be made as a credible argument as embedded in Grutter, then the court would have a little bit harder time saying that the Seattle and Hunter cases don't apply. So I'm not sure how it would all work out, but I'm wondering if the court won't necessarily have to clarify that issue left over from Grutter.
Jennifer can answer as well, but my guess is that they're not going to clarify it, even if they reverse the Sixth Circuit, because there is inherent tension in any of the court's race cases where they kind of say there's no balancing. I mean, the whole notion of diversity and critical mass, and where do those concepts end and balancing begin, become very, very difficult. I think if you go back and look at the arguments that they had in Fisher, you know, the court and counsel went round and round and round about, well, you know, how do we know that, how do you judge if you have a critical mass and need to start using race to increase your diversity? How, you know, do you look at the numbers, and the university saying, oh, no, we can't look at the numbers because that would be a quota and that would be racial balancing and we can't do that under Grutter. But Grutter instructs us that we have to continually evaluate our class to see if we've reached a critical mass. But what is that critical mass? And it ends up being a circular argument. So I think you've pointed out a tension that's in all the court's race decisions. I think in this case, it won't be necessary for them to decide it one way or another to get into that question. The real tension in this case about diversity is one that Jennifer raised earlier, it did not really come out at oral argument too much, but was raised in the briefs, and it was raised in our brief, actually, as well as by some others, is that under a Grutter plan, the only way a Grutter plan is constitutional is if it's a diverse student body for the, you know, educational benefit of everybody. And the only way the political restructuring doctrine is triggered is if a particular policy is adopted intentionally for the benefit of the minority, is the way it's phrased in Hunter and Seattle. And so those two propositions from Grutter and from Hunter and Seattle are in kind of direct conflict. And here, of course, what we tried to point out is, and Jennifer mentioned is true, is there's a bit of hypocrisy on the part of affirmative action supporters who essentially argued that the Grutter plans were adopted for anyone's benefit so everyone could achieve the benefits of a diverse student body when that was necessary to meet the test of Bakke and under a Grutter plan. And now, essentially in order to shoehorn this case into the political restructuring doctrine, they need to make the argument that affirmative action plans are intended to benefit minorities. And are not intended to benefit everybody.
So ironically, Justice O'Connor's language, you could describe that as dictum. Michigan itself, or excuse me, the BAM, is sort of stopped from asserting that as their rationale because the university repudiated that rationale back in 2003, and so they're essentially stopped from it. I take it that it's a sort of a kind of a weird kind of estoppel argument that you want to.
There's a contradiction there. I'm not saying it's a formal estoppel argument, but there's certainly a contradiction there. I hope the court picks up on that. Essentially, I mean, if you look at it, a Grutter plan could not meet the test for the political restructuring doctrine because the Grutter plan is not adopted for the benefit of the minority. And a plan that is adopted for the benefit of the minority that meets the political restructuring test of Hunter and Seattle would be unconstitutional under Grutter. So there is a kind of bizarre tension among the affirmative action advocates in Michigan. The court didn't directly seize upon it, but hopefully when they go back and read briefs some more, they might raise that point in the decision.
Thank you.
We've got about 5 minutes. We've got two questions remaining, so I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible. Let's go to the next caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on. You might have muted your phone. Okay. Apparently, we're having a technical difficulty with that caller. Let's try the next one.
This is David Applegate in Chicago again. What gives this coalition of interest groups standing to sue?
That was actually raised in some of the moot courts, and it was it really wasn't questioned from what I gather and from what I understand. It was assumed that at least some of the students that are part of the coalition would have standing because they would, they say that they would have applied would like the university to give them special consideration because of their race, and that because of this constitutional amendment, they are unduly harmed. I just want to take a moment, and I want to point out what Justice O'Connor said the day after Michigan voters passed this ballot initiative. She happened to be speaking in Ohio the morning after Election Day in 2006, and someone asked her what she thought of the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative passing, and she said, and I quote, "It is entirely within the rights and privileges of voters to do so." While she's no longer on the court, I think that that speaks to what she was thinking as she penned the majority opinion in Grutter, and especially as she penned that quote, directing people to take this to the voters or to legislatures and to potentially change policy at the state level.
Bob Driscoll, do you have a response on
this? No, I mean, there were several. That was not a focus of the argument, and it wasn't a focus of our brief. There were two groups of respondents, and I assume part of that was to make sure somebody had standing. There was a group of university administrators and others in one group, and then the By Any Means Necessary group was kind of a coalition of students, and potential students and others, who I think probably would fall within, at least under the, you know, the protected minority status of the Hunter-Seattle Doctrine, I assume. But I assume that was all litigated below, and it was not contested strongly by either side in the court.
If I could just add, if the Attorney General had chosen not to appeal the Sixth Circuit decision, because of the recent decisions involving Prop 8 out of California, it would have been us who would not have had standing to then appeal that decision. And that's a concern as someone who is deeply involved in the ballot initiative process and in taking initiatives to the people that oftentimes politicians are not supportive of and want nothing to do with. And so I'm thankful that both Attorney General Cox, former Attorney General Cox, and Attorney General Schuette have stepped up and defended this amendment.
Well, I think we will let that be our final word here today. We are out of time. I want to thank both Jennifer Gratz and Bob Driscoll for not only attending the oral argument, of course, but also for joining us on the call today. I thought this was a fascinating discussion. I certainly appreciate your time and your insights. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we'll be hosting Chuck Cooper talking about diversity jurisdiction in federal court in a case he has ongoing litigation. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.